A podcast of the cinema.
Hey, guess what?
What?
My name's Dave White.
It is.
I'm a film critic.
Mm-hmm.
Your name is
yes.
Alonzo Duralde.
It is.
You're a film critic.
I am.
And this is a show we do. We've done it since 2010. We've been film critics for longer.
Yes.
We've been film critics on a podcast for...
going on 14
years. That's so stupid.
And yet here we are.
All right, so guess what, everybody? Remember last time we had that episode where we sat around and we talked to other film critics that we know? Justin Chang, Peter DeBruch, Robert Abele, Manola Dargis. And we didn't talk about any current in-theater movies.
Not really,
We talked about 2023. We talked about all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you were thinking... can't wait for David Alonso to get right back in and talk about the movies. Too bad.
We will soon.
You honest. Lose, but in reality you win. Because today we're not reviewing a single film.
No.
We are going to instead do our very best to catch up with all the letters and emails
yes.
that you have sent us. It is completely unlikely that we're going to finish this in 1 hour because we only have an hour today.
Yeah.
Why do we only have an hour today? Because I'm cooking Sunday dinner. In a very long process of lentil-based meatballs. There's no meat in them.
No.
But
you're eating into valuable letter time.
I've been going at it for 2 days now, preparing the various elements.
If you want to hear the full story about
them. I even test made some this afternoon yes. to see how they worked, because I've had the hell of a time making lentil meatballs that A, taste good, and B, don't fall apart.
That cohere.
And I feel like today I have succeeded. I have succeeded in making them not fall apart, and I think they taste pretty good.
Well, you can get the full aftermath story.
That's not important right now.
At patreon.com/
We're not doing a Patreon ad right now. I'm just telling everybody about my important day.
Okay. Well, you're cutting into everyone else's time.
No, this is the show.
But I know, but today we're here for the letter writers.
I cannot be put in your box.
Cram you though I might.
I'm not here for that. I'm here to explain the beauty of my life. Dude, I'm making an apple tart too. I've already set the laid the groundwork for that. I've already cut out my puff pastry.
Nice.
It crushed a bunch of butter in the bottom of the pan, the sugar. Gonna peel the apples the minute we're done talking. Oh, how delicious it's all gonna be. We got a letter, though.
Yes. We have several.
First of many. Settle in. Sit back. Maybe yours. Maybe a letter you sent us. Maybe a letter you sent us 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and you forgot you even sent it. Maybe we'll get to it.
Who can say?
Maybe not. The timer's running. This is from Grant, the movie and TV guy. Hey, Alonzo and Dave. Yesterday, I attended a screening of The Taste of Things at my local art house, and I loved it. Afterwards, I discovered that later in the evening, the theater would be screening The Last Picture Show. That's one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I'm currently reading the book.
Yeah.
Having never seen this film, I thought I'd stick around. I'm glad I did. I was wondering what you both thought of The Last Picture Show. Thanks, as always, for your terrific insights. Let me tell you something about The Last Picture Show. I saw it for the first time when I was in my 20s. Hmm. And it, what's the word? Is there a word maybe it's not even a word in English, but there's a word for when you see something and you feel so under-distanced from it.
Mm.
You don't even know if it's good or not because your whole body is going, That's how I feel about the last picture
show. What was that line from that old computer game? Are they reading my diary?
Are they reading my diary? Yeah. That's a movie.
Yeah.
Having spent a good chunk of my young life in eastern New Mexico, which, as anyone will tell you, is merely west Texas. Sorry, people in New Mexico. It's true.
I saw Last Picture Show when I first moved to Dallas. It came back to a theater there because they were shooting Texasville.
Yes.
The not-so-hot sequel.
Yes.
And because there was a lot of just buzz about that, they brought it to the Glen Lakes. It wasn't even like at the Lard House or whatever. The AMC Theater. And it knocked me out. And I had read about it for years, so I sort of knew things to look for and that kind of thing. It didn't reflect my childhood the way it did for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, no, I admired it. And I had already been a big fan of Bogdanovich, obviously, you know, because of What's Up, Doc? And Paper Moon. But, yeah, no, it's an extraordinary film.
May I now continue what I was about to say?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mm, may I?
Do.
Having grown up in the actual geographical location where this film is meant to be, you know, set, I can tell you that whether it took place in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, that feeling of isolation and sort of small town loneliness, watching things move in a way that it makes you feel like you're stuck in molasses and you need to go, you need to get out. Obviously, the things that happen in the film and the book are not things that happened to me, but there's a sense of, a pervasive sense of sorrow and loneliness and isolation, I think, that takes place in that film. And you're, you know, watching things shrivel up is, and that's kind of always how I felt when I was a kid there. I was not an especially happy teenager in that region, but yeah, that movie is tremendous. Anyone who hasn't seen it,
it's a must.
Please, yeah, you really should get out, get it in front of your eyes. Greg. Oh, Greg. He says, Dave and I are on the same wavelength regarding Nimona.
Hmm.
I respect the themes and the story and the metaphor and the performances, but I was put off by the design of the world and the animation aesthetic. Hmm. But the big climax really got me. I'm a sucker for a meaningful embrace. No, you know, you and I were in the minority. People love that movie.
No, I liked it more than you did.
No, I mean me and Greg.
Oh, yeah.
Not you.
Sorry, yes. Silly me.
No, no one's talking to you right now.
Ah. Oh.
Do you have any other thoughts about Nimona and what did you just drop on the floor?
That was my phone.
Your phone just dropped on the floor. Okay.
No, I get what you're saying. It didn't get in the way of my enjoying the film.
Yeah. Joan. Hello, Joan. She says, the All of Us Strangers talk had me tearing up in my car.
Oh.
I appreciate how... Well, you know, I'm very moving.
Well, you do cut an onion. That makes me cry.
I appreciate how Alonso described it as a movie he admired but not loved, I think. I feel similarly. In some ways, the parental conversations were just so writerly that you can almost see the hand of the author or director on screen. But in thinking about it later, I came to the conclusion, why not? If this is a fantasy for this character, why not let it be a full fantasia of emotional catharsis? It just never occurred to me that you could do that. Yeah, I also think that the conversations were writerly And I think that was sort of the point.
Character's a writer.
The character's a writer, and he's constructing the world of the past that he wishes he had with his parents. He's also constructing the world of the present that he wishes he was having with Paul Mescal. And who doesn't?
Well, sure. Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about how Spy Magazine back in the 80s, I guess, used to do that thing of directors who cast better looking versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Their main example being David Lynch and Kyle MacLachlan.
Okay.
But Andrew Haig is actually real handsome.
Yeah, he's a good looking dude.
So, yeah.
He's just scouted some peers.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Yeah. His equals.
You're weird. Daniel says, thank you so much for your discussion about the issues surrounding All of Us Strangers. I loved the movie. But even more than that, I needed to hear you talk about dealing with the issues of growing up queer. I'm almost 60 and still dealing with it. I think it's important for us to acknowledge this and be able to talk about it. I also think other queer people are sometimes our biggest barrier to being able to express it. I'm glad that people our age are finally talking about AIDS, but for so long, we who survived were kind of dismissed. I'm so happy to have this.
You know, this takes me back, and we've talked about this a bunch, but like, I think the reason that a lot of gay people didn't like bros was because they sort of say the quiet part out loud. There's that whole movie, that whole scene where the movie kind of yes. stops being a comedy.
We talked about that in our All of Us Strangers discussion.
Yeah. And I think that just the people really shy away from gay people, shy away from that conversation happening out loud in public.
The biggest sin you can commit as an openly, happily queer adult is to mourn the past.
Yeah.
Because what we don't want from each other is whining.
Yes.
And that's always the word.
We're so well adjusted.
That's always the word that they use. What are you whining about?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, stuff back then, it sucked. And
you carry it with you forever.
You carry it with you for all of your life. And you spend each day like, you know, placing it in its proper context yeah. or not dealing with it at all. And wondering why you're spinning your wheels emotionally or in other areas of your life, it is stuff that needs to be said out loud. I have found in my life, though, more sympathetic ears are with straight friends.
Yeah.
Because other queer people are like, dude, I have problems of my own. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And they're like, can we just go have fun right now? Must we like talk about the traumas of our childhood?
Right.
Well, I mean, you kind of have to do sometimes. It's not like every day. Like, no. Here's a good example. When I was in my early 20s, I started going, and I may have already talked about this. I can't even remember. I started going to Al-Anon meetings and Adult Children of Alcoholics meetings because that's where I come from. And after about a year of it, I quit. Because I couldn't wallow in it every week the way I had, because that is what it felt like doing. Not mm-hmm. so much Al-Anon. Al-Anon was a far more established thing. This was the 80s, and ACOA had not quite been well established yet. And so it was kind of a free-for-all. It was like the Wild West of those kinds of meetings. And after about a year of it, I was like, okay, this isn't helping. So when I say talk about it, I don't mean like
stew in it constantly.
Every day, all the time, stew in it constantly and you know, burden all your friends all the time. But, you know, get some friends who you can talk to about just about anything.
Yeah, don't tamp it down.
Michael says, regarding last episode mm-hmm. with everybody, best film reviewers assemble. I look forward to this gathering every year.
Oh, thank you.
Larry says, earworm, you guys win. I have no idea what this means.
It was a joke. I think we were talking about the music in Dune or something with
uh-huh.
Justin, and I made an earworm joke.
Oh, did Justin?
No, I made.
Did you and Justin and probably Robert?
Yeah.
Jeez. The three of you together. Separately, it's too much. But the three of you together, it's like, I'll go in the other room now while y'all pun each other into submission. Michelle says, last night we saw Dune 2, The Sands of Chalamet. In a smaller theater with smaller screens that cater to the neighborhood experience, you can get food, you can get drinks. We listened to the people behind us talk about reading the book Dune for the first time. I hope they weren't talking about this during the film. At the start of each screening, they run just random movies while people settle into their seats. I guess, oh, like short things? Okay. Last night, it was the 1987 cartoon Gandahar, which I don't know.
Don't know it.
Tickets are $8. There is one trailer.
Ooh.
Instead of 25 minutes at AMC, for example, so you're not exhausted before the movie even starts. I think how you see movies still matters, not just what movies you're screening. This little theater in Lake Oswego? Oswego?
Oswego?
How do you pronounce this, Michelle? I don't know how. She said, it keeps us going.
So we went to an AMC yesterday.
Yeah.
For the first time since they have introduced the Chopped and Channeled Nicole remix,
mm-hmm.
which was weird. What were the movies that she saw now?
What new movies did they put in the little clips?
I tried to commit them to memory and then I forgot.
I don't know. It was my first time. I'll have it memorized soon enough.
Yeah. And so it was like, it was all...
They put new clips in it. They took some outtakes, I assume, from the last time.
Yeah. There was a new line of her like looking at the camera and saying, it's magic.
It's magic. Yeah. There's another outtake that they use as well. Mm. They put in two new little things that you've never seen before.
They took out the hallway.
Chopped a whole bunch. She's not walking down the hall anymore. She doesn't tell you that you're there to laugh, to cry, to care.
To care.
What I need, what I want, is them to get her back into a theater, a new pantsuit, a new script, do it all over again. If you need it to be shorter, make it shorter.
Sure.
But don't chop up the one I already know that I've got memorized,
yes.
that I'm ready to like move my lips along,
yes.
to. And take out a trailer or two. I don't need the new. I don't need.
That's
I do
the
not need
on
all
a huge
those.
Silver screen.
Do not need all those trailers.
So many trailers.
Yeah. All right. Shoddy. Dear David Alonso, Liberace equals screws around. Steven Soderbergh, he was a demented evil bastard. That was not how I read that movie. He was demented and evil. He was ruined in many ways.
I think if that movie takes issue with Liberace's behavior, it's not that that he slept around a lot. It's that he was controlling and lied about HIV and...
He did that too. Yeah, okay, that is pretty evil.
And treated his exes...
I forgot about that part.
Treated his exes shabbily.
All right, Shoddy, you're right. Okay. Sondheim equals screws around.
No,
Sondheim.
Sondheim? Bernstein.
Oh, no. She wrote Sondheim. She meant Bernstein.
Okay.
Bernstein screws around. Bradley Cooper. He was a complicated victim of the closet who loved his very tolerant, saintly wife. I mean, also, you're right.
Yeah, no, that is a fair adjustment.
You're right. You're right. You're always correct. Daniel, regarding the group hang, says, I love that you were almost 49 minutes in before the Oscars were mentioned.
Yeah, the only reason
we
called it an Oscar preview is because we dropped the ball on getting this together in early January.
Yeah.
And then Sundance happened, and then... various other things happened.
Stop blaming yourself. There was no ball dropped. There was just a lot of complications with, scheduling and my dumb body being
life
ready
got in the way.
Yeah, so don't worry about it. It happened.
Yeah.
Our friends, the film critics, they came to our home.
We got to do it.
We love them. We had a wonderful conversation.
I forgot to take a picture, as I so often do.
You always forget. Doesn't matter. Manola just turns her back to the camera anyway. Never matters. She won't be photographed.
No, I understand that. But like, you know.
She literally turns her back when the camera's taken. And we just let her do it. What are we going to do? Not let her
we
do
respect
it?
Respect her privacy.
You don't not let Manola Dargis do anything.
Three other people who we could have, you know.
She does whatever she wants.
We could have featured and we neglected to do so.
Robert Kirby says, I look forward to this episode every year. Thank you for another lovely conversation.
Oh, well, thank you, sir.
Mint says, okay, so settle in. This is a three-paragrapher. It's a pretty long letter. You ready? Let's go. I really liked your discussion of Zone of Interest. And I definitely fall closer to the side of Alonzo on the film. A pretty constant part of how I respond to films like this stems from how you regularly invoke films like The Help as giving audiences a good white person to identify with so they can say, I would be one of the good ones. And thank you for both giving me this lens. I think Zone of Interest is interesting in how it doesn't provide characters like that, while also being pretty clear that ordinary audiences would not be in this family's position, i.e. wouldn't be the commandant or the family of the commandant of a concentration camp. With maybe the exception of the wife's mother, we go through much of the film without someone to identify strongly with. We keep seeing things we recognize. For me, the big one was the roof on the other side of the wall, as the traces of the evil happening, and yet our position with respect to them is as unclear as our position with respect to the night vision scenes. The rest of this letter includes spoilers. Are we okay with that? We're okay with that.
I think Zone of Interest has been around for a while. People know.
To me, the key of the film is the mix of those night vision scenes and the flash-forward vision at the end. Through the film, we constantly see people taking care of the commandant's house, maids and workers there to make the family comfortable, but the night vision and flash-forward give us two alternate visions of caring. The night vision shows us care as requiring a kind of risk, that when one can't radically change the evil circumstances, that our acts of care require risking something of ourselves to care for others. The flash forward, though, brings us back to the kind of domestic work we saw in the house, except here it is an expression of public resources, people's tax dollars, being spent on caring for this space, this memory. The scene wouldn't work the same if we actually saw tourists coming into this museum. In short, I think it's a mistake to see the flash forward as some kind of the arc of history bends toward justice vision for the evil man. It's not about warning him that he's on the wrong side of history. It's drawing a parallel to his housekeepers in the context of the film that is all about noticing what things, objects, mean. He sees nothing in that vision but signs of waste, of things that are discarded and should be hidden away, things not requiring care. But we as spectators see this space being cared for, and the lesson of that image is that our history requires caring for, especially in cases where humanity as a whole failed to care for the people who actually lived in those historical moments. Mint, I think you might be changing my entire opinion of this movie. Continuing. In other words, the film gives us three visions of care. One which is never enough to make the world more than comfortable for the few, another which shows that we have to risk something to care for people who are in desperate need of caring for, and a last one which is about what care we owe when we fail to take that risk. The first kind of care is clearly visible but insufficient. The second kind of care is literally hard to see as it's happening, and the third is Sisyphean in that we have to give these acts meaning or else they seem absurd. The film doesn't give us a revolutionary program, but it draws these relations between caring and seeing that I think point us to reorient how we see suffering in the world as the expression of things needing to be cared for. And that's why I haven't stopped thinking about it since I saw it in December.
Wow.
Okay. Do you want to be a permanent co-host of this podcast, Mint, because you're smarter than me?
I had not found the words for that, but that's a really great expression, I think, of particularly the flash forward at the end. I think that really captures what it's there for and what it's meant to make us leave thinking about.
Okay. Kevin says, after listening to your discussion of The Zone of Interest, I thought you brought up an interesting point about individual responses to movies and when folks' negative criticisms can be others' praises. Specifically, I've seen reviews of Zone of Interest say, not to put words in anyone's mouth, but generally, it is too steeped in abstraction and is not as effective as it thinks it is due to that abstraction. When I hear this, I kind of think, isn't that the point of the movie, though? The abstraction is the evil the film is highlighting. It's kind of an annoying non-rebuttal that even I roll my eyes at when people claim it. In this case, though, I completely understand if Zone doesn't work for people. Not in a snotty, ooh, it's a movie that isn't for everyone kind of way, but in a genuine, I understand if you just don't buy the tone or argument the movie is making. Do you have any thoughts on when people say, isn't that the point of the movie? Are there times when you can swallow or believe that response better than others? Do you ever push back when somebody gives you that response? Any examples? Of course, everyone's response is their own, but do you ever try to challenge if you think someone is fundamentally misunderstanding the film?
I think there are certainly examples along the way that are pretty clear. I always think about that initial wave of Josie and the Pussycats reviews,
right,
that thought that the product placement was overbearing and didn't understand that it was satirical.
That was, the product placement was very, very narratively intentional.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are times when I can find that argument frustrating. For example, I've always said that my problem with Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers is that anything you point out that is a flaw or is too obvious or, you know, overbearing about it, one could say, well, it's meant to be that way.
Right.
It's supposed to be that way. That's the point of it. And if it, and that takes it to a level that it sort of negates it all, you know, that it's just hammering you on the head, but because it claims to be meaning to do so, it's all right, you know? So I think that there are layers of interpretation for anything, but absolutely there are times, I think, where the thing that people might see is a... another example that comes up a lot, at least it used to, in the early years after the release of 2001, there were people who thought they were being very clever by saying, well, the most human character in the film is the computer.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
Right.
Like, Kubrick is giving us these sort of very blank, dehumanized people of the future who have been subsumed by technology.
Right.
But he's doing it intentionally. It's not that they're badly written or that the performances are stiff. They're doing exactly what he asked them to do.
That moment when you know, you just know you're smarter than the filmmaker.
that they didn't think it through the way you have.
Right. Yeah. I used to work in a record... I'll start that all over again.
Jeez.
I used to work in a record store. In fact, I worked in three different record stores when I lived back in Texas. Three record stores in succession. And here's the first lesson I learned. Don't talk to anybody about music. And by that, I mean this. If somebody walks in and says to you, man, Pearl Jam, what a band. Your response is, that's right.
Aisle two.
Right. And if they say to you, do you like Pearl Jam? You say, sure. Like you're asking them for a nice Hawaiian punch. Like, you agree.
This
unless they're your friends.
Yeah, sure.
If you already know, I'm sure. But what I'm getting at is something that Andy said.
I was going to say.
Something that Andy said on
Revolutions Per Movie.
Revolutions Per Movie, a podcast we were listening to this weekend.
Our friend Andy was
a guest on this show.
And he was famously the music geek on the Comedy Central game show Beat the Geeks,
yes,
alongside our friend Mark Hoyk, who is the movie geek.
Yeah.
And Andy talked about how when people would recognize him,
they would ask him
for validation.
If he thought their favorite band was cool.
Yeah.
So a long time ago, I wrote a book, and on a random page in the book, I insult the band Stone Temple Pilots because I never liked them. Somebody I know read the book during the pandemic and contacted me and laid into me about that.
In 2020?
In 2020. Well, you know, everyone was bored.
I guess.
And I listened, and I said, you know what? I'm sure that, and I'm blanking on his name, the lead guy who died, I can't remember his name now, I'm sure he was really talented. And I know for certain that record companies don't just sign, you know, bands that can't do anything. They wrote songs. They impacted lots of people. They sold millions of records. People loved them. I couldn't see them or hear them for the way you saw them or heard them. So you're not wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe someday in the future I'll hear them again and go, oh, you know what? They were always great. But again, I'll remind you, friend, that I wrote this book 20 years ago. So we're not having a fight right now. Getting back to the original point, when someone sees a film differently than I do, I do not have the energy to argue. Back in the day, working in the record store, it was about holding my tongue,
mm-hmm,
and making a sale and not crapping on people, because you never convince anybody,
exactly,
of anything. You can tell them all day long, Stone Temple Pilots, Pearl Jam. Listen, I'm from the 90s, so that's why. But you can say that all day long, and they will dig in their heels, and they will know that you are a boob. You're dumb. You don't know what you're talking about. How did you even get hired to work in this record store? How did you even get hired to review movies? You don't know anything because you don't like what I like.
Or vice versa.
And so I have... From holding my tongue to simply not caring enough to have arguments with people. Here's what I always do now, because I think this is the wisest thing to do. Number one, always recognize that your taste is not infallible.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding the fact that Alonzo and I routinely tell each other that the other one is wrong about certain movies, that's for fun and done from a place of marital bliss.
Your opinion is not empirical.
Right, exactly. It doesn't weigh anything other than the authority that you bring with it as a person who has developed a sense of, you know, taste over the years. Another person might have done exactly the same thing that you did with their life, studied it and immersed themselves in it, and might have come away seeing the same film you saw in an entirely different way. Do you want to fight them about it? And if so, why? Why can't you just say, hey man, we saw different films. I read that differently. Here's what I think. Would you like to know what I think about this? I'll tell you. Then you can have a conversation. I'm not saying you can't have a discussion. A discussion about it, but the idea of, you know, you missed the point in the snotty way that you're describing.
Yeah.
No way, man. I'm not ever.
Tell you what broke me in the habit of ever wanting to get into these sort of conversations was social media.
Mm-hmm.
It has amazed me over the years, the people who like tally all the things that I am quote unquote wrong about and will like unleash them with every time I'm wrong about a new thing. You know, like, there is a breed of always a guy. There's a breed of guy out there.
I'm sorry, it is always a guy.
Yes.
It's always a dude.
Will never forgive me for the fact that I didn't like Warcraft. And that I did like the live action, I don't even remember what it's called now. Mm. Some anime adaptation.
Okay.
Thing. And I was like, look, it's a dumb, fun movie. If your kids have never seen a Hong Kong action film before, this is maybe a good starter. It's even got Chow Yun-fat in it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, what movie is it? If he would know. I can never remember the name of it. Anyway, but like like these things were just these lines in the sand that proved that I had no idea what I'm talking about. It's just like, okay.
I've caught you.
Yes.
I've caught you and I've trapped you.
Exactly. How dare I think I know anything about movies when I'm clearly so wrong about blah, blah, blah. So, somebody actually came on, you know, bowed up at me on Blue Sky recently. It's like, I can't believe we saw the same movie, blah, 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 blah.
Well, you did.
And my response was, no two people see the same movie.
You saw the same movie, and you saw different things, and you heard different things, and you felt different things, and yeah, you thought different things. And you walked out of the theater, and you looked at each other, and you said, that was great. And the other person said, that sucked.
Yeah, no two people watch or listen to anything with the same eyeballs and the same experiences and the same general opinions about aesthetics or, you know, what the world should be or whatever. So, yeah, we didn't see the same movie. No one does.
Back in the 80s when I was doing my semester of student teaching, my cooperating teacher was this great old lady who, she was with it. Like, she was still, like, cool and funny and sharp and everything. She loved talking about movies with me. And I would tell her, she'd go, what'd you see? What have you seen lately? And I would just tell her. And she was like, where's that? And I was like, it's way out at the end of town at the Cinemark where they've got one screen devoted to like art house films. She'd go out and see something that I recommended and she'd be like, And then the cook, the thief, his wife, and her lover came to Lubbock, Texas. And I went to see it, and I was like, whoa! I told her about it. And she goes, I'm going to take my husband to see that. Monday morning, she walks into the class, and she goes, you are a pervert. And then she laughed, and she goes, I can't believe you told me to go see that. I was like, I didn't make you do it.
That's like the Monday at the newspaper in Nashville where this woman was like annoyed with me because she had gone with a date to see Love is a Dog from Hell.
Oh, I had liked it. Okay.
And I said, I didn't say take a date to it.
Yeah, friends, all my whole life, going to movies with friends and us walking out of the movie and having radically different opinions. A dear friend who lives here in Los Angeles. When we all went to see Beau Travail, you're not the only Beau Travail hater in the world. This other friend, we walked out of it when it was over and he goes, between that in that G.D. Donkey movie you love so much. I'm never listening to you again. I said, fine, don't listen to me again. You'll listen to me again. Just you wait and see. Yeah. Glenn. Friend Glenn. Hello, friend Glenn.
Hello, Glenn.
Local friend Glenn. Regarding your review of Origin, I wanted to correct you on your discussion of the story of the little boy discriminated against at a public pool. Mm. In your discussion, you stated that it took place in the South. It's easy to make that assumption when discussing Jim Crow. However, the story took place in my hometown of Youngstown, Ohio, in 1951. For me, the distinction is important, as it's easy to associate the story with the South, yet this type of segregation happened all over the place, including the Midwest.
Totally.
The young boy in question, his name was Al Bright. He grew up to be legendary. His art hangs in Youngstown's Butler Institute, and he also has the distinction of being the first African-American full-time faculty member at his alma mater, Youngstown State University. His surviving wife, Dr. D. Banks, is also a friend of my family. Al Bright was slash is an important part of Youngstown's history and is an inspiration for his accomplishments and for his triumphing despite his childhood experiences.
Wow.
I didn't know that. Did we say it was the South? I guess we just assumed.
Thank you for the clarification, Glenn. Sorry I got that wrong.
Dr. Steve says, I caught Madam Webb on a weekday matinee. Those are the best. Oh, man, they're the best. Weekday matinees that start at like 10 a.m. if you live in a big city and those happen. Ah, perfection.
Lunch after.
The whole place. It's like 28 days later. The whole place belongs to you. He says, I love weekday matinees. They make me feel like I'm playing hooky from school. Regarding the movie itself, not the worst. Just rather, meh. If I have any complaints, the biggest is that it keeps showing us flashes of a much more exciting movie that we never get to see.
This is true.
Jack says, I would like to share an old mid-century family recipe to pair with Dune Part 2. Number 1, smash graham crackers into fine bits. Number 2, sprinkle in some LSD. What grocery store do they sell that at?
I don't know.
Is that like Accent?
It might. That's MSG.
Oh, MSG. Number 3, stir in gummy worms. Voila, your very own Arrakis bowl. Dune Part 2 in theaters March 2nd. My question for you is, have you enjoyed any particularly memorable themed movie snacks? Signed, Jack, last name withheld.
themed movie snacks.
Like, do you mean snacks that were made in conjunction with a film's release that were sold, that were branded to the film?
I think he means either that or like ones you've made at home. I once attended a screening of Valley of the Dolls where they gave everybody M&Ms in those little paper cups that you get at hospitals when they meds.
That's funny.
That was cute.
That's adorable. Well, the all-time grand champion, really, for that, for me, is the Wonka candy line that was in the 70s.
Mm, yes.
That film was made...
The raison d'etre of the movie.
That film was made by Quaker Oats because they wanted to brand a line of candy.
Yeah.
Chocolate bars and other types of candy to tie in with the movie. The initial run of the film was not financially successful, but the candy wound up in stores and was on shelves for years.
Yeah, I was a big fan of... Yeah. They had a thing called of the Oompa Loompas, which were basically like... Imagine a Reese's piece and an M&M grafted together. So it was a candy-covered, half-chocolate, half-peanut butter.
Yeah, those were good. The Scrum-diddly-umptious bar, I liked that, too.
Yeah.
My only disappointment with those was that in the film itself, the Wonka chocolate bars are huge.
Yeah.
They're big, they're thick. If you've ever had a Tony's Chocolonely bar, you know, big fat chocolate bars that they make now, that's roughly kind of how they look. The Wonka bars in the movie look like that.
Yeah.
And I always just salivated when Charlie finally got his hands on one and just shoves it in his mouth.
That big, thick, the long bar, but the, yeah.
And I just remember, how come I can't have a chocolate bar like that? And then I would be thinking, like, how come the actual Wonka bars that I can buy down the street at the corner store from my house. How come none of the, how come that one isn't there? Do you, that was always my bummer.
Do you remember the revival of the Wonka bar in like the 2000s? I don't know if it was Nestle or somebody put them out.
Yeah, yeah.
Those were pretty good.
They were not bad, yeah.
And it didn't, they didn't last very long. The Wonka brand continues to this day with like a lot of non-chocolate stuff like Nerds.
Right.
And, you know, the very Nerds rope and the Nerds gummies now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I miss Wonka chocolate. And they had these tie-ins to the new Wonka gummies that they sold in theaters, but they all tasted like the same flavor to me.
Mm. Jack sent us a second email to clarify that the graham crackers were meant to be the sand.
Yes.
The gummy worms were meant to be the worms.
Yes.
And the LSD was meant to be the spice.
Yes, yes.
Let's actually do this for a second here. Crumble up the graham crackers.
Uh-huh.
I don't want gummy worms. I want those soft little mini marshmallows.
Okay.
You can roll them into worm shapes if it suits you, I guess. But then the spice, what I want is like little shaved bits of chocolate.
So you want a deconstructed s'more.
I want a deconstructed s'more that I could just eat in my hand, like just toss it back like I'm digging into a bowl. Like I'm digging into a box of Honey Nut Cheerios as a snack. You know,
I don't know that I want graham crumbs. Like maybe, you know,
I would be okay with that.
Okay, maybe like Teddy Grahams, like small mouth-sized grahams.
Teddy Grahams. Do they still make those? Do they still
they
make?
Might. I don't know.
It's been a long time since I've had an actual graham cracker. Now that I'm now come to think,
yeah, I'm a fan.
Yeah, same here. Chris Robles, Donut Chris Robles. We have two Chris Robleses
in our listening audience.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about All of Us Strangers until you mentioned it on the show the other day, and you mentioned what I posted on Instagram. I think partly I thought it was going to be more of a spooky gay ghost mystery, and then it was more of a straightforward drama with ghostly elements. And I'm not sure why I thought it was going to be a gay Hercule Poirot with ghosts. But that's also not a bad idea for a movie.
Or like a gay Scooby-Doo. You
know? Yeah. Oh, wait, you know what? We've already read this letter.
Really?
Yeah. All right. Nordeast B?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Says, regarding Robbie Williams. let us make this the year, 2024, where we are always talking about Robbie Williams.
Somebody wants it that way.
I remember him being on Leno in 2004 or 2005. It was clearly a push to finally break out in the United States, and it just went nowhere. My husband and I are big fans and realize that if we ever want to see him live, we're going to have to shell out for flights to Europe. Is that true, though? I mean, he doesn't perform in the U.S., even though he, like, lives here, basically, half the time.
But then, look, this movie could change it all.
It could.
Yeah.
It could. But you know what? Even Kylie Minogue started sort of touring in small ways in the U.S., like big cities.
Right, but she'd had a hit here. For
truncated dates. But no, she hadn't had a hit here when she finally got herself over here to tour.
It was before Can't Get You Out of My Head?
No, it was like 10 years after Can't Get You Out of My Head.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Robbie Williams...
You don't tour 10 years after your one hit.
If you have enough gays in your corner, you do.
She did it because she had enough gays in her corner.
Yes.
But it still was a very truncated situation.
Well,
like
I don't think Robbie's even got that.
Right. He doesn't have the gays that he needs to have to make that viable. That's actually true. Steve, not Dr. Steve, other Steve.
Other Steve.
But also in-person friend Steve, just like Dr. Steve.
True.
So, you know.
Venn diagram city.
Additional bewilderment at the big buy of U.S. rights for the Robbie Williams the Robbie Williams biopic. In November, Netflix put out a 4-part documentary series on him. Did anybody watch it? Did anyone know of it? The spot on YouTube leans very heavily into him confronting his personal demons. Maybe that'll be more palatable in theaters with a peppy beat, or maybe that component will be politely swept under the carpet as someone fascinated by his high profile absolutely everywhere but here. I can't wait to find out. Well, here's the other thing, Steve. What personal demons? No one knows what they are in the United States. They're going to have to show him having them,
yes,
and then show him getting out of them.
In the U.S., yeah, we don't know the person, let alone the personal demons.
Yeah. Jesse, on the very important topic of international superstar Robbie Williams, I take umbrage at your erasure of straight girls who studied abroad in the late 1990s. Early aughts, as we are the American population familiar with and fanatical about Robbie Williams. Oh, and he has two albums of standards. The second, Swings Both Ways, cough, cough, LOL, get it, everyone.
Oh, boy.
Was released in 2013. The title track is a duet with Rufus Wainwright. Sincerely, probably going to Hyde Park to see Robbie in concert in July.
Wow.
I also watched the four-part Netflix documentary.
Well, there you go, Steve. Jesse watched it. And people in Europe.
Robert, another one from Robert Kirby. Hmm. Old reliable Robert. Yeah. That's what we call you.
Bless him.
Really appreciated the conversations about American fiction and especially The Zone of Interest, which I found brilliant. It spurred me to rewatch Birth this morning and putting Sexy Beast on the queue for a rewatch, and of course to rewatch Under the Skin again because it's stone cold great. And your negotiations over the plot synopses made me laugh. That lasagna Dave made sounds worth the extra work, Alonzo.
You don't got to tell me.
It is worth the extra work. Finally, another one from Daniel. Regarding Maestro, I question just how much Leonard Bernstein was closeted and how aware his wife and family were about him. I haven't seen the movie yet, but it does show his 80th birthday, where Lorne Bacall sang a parody of The Ballad of Jenny with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim about him being bisexual. His children seem to be aware, and they don't seem to care all that much. I do want to watch it all, though. I still have some PTSD from the Cole Porter biopic, DeLovely, where his homosexuality was treated as the great tragedy of his and his wife's lives. Yeah. No, I thought this one, I thought Maestro was really sort of sympathetic to his life, her life.
No, I don't know how much of it is the kids are alive and in charge of the estate or what, but yeah, it is sympathetic is one way to put it. I think it might also be a bit soft-pedaled.
Well, you and I saw different films,
didn't we? Which brings us back to Doe. All right.
Which brings us back to, I gotta put an apple tart in the oven.
You do, which brings us back to Doe, like I said.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
It brings us back to how you hate my puns. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Again, we really do have a Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. Where we do lots of extra shows.
I'm going to lay out this whole apple tart on Linoleum Knife and Fork.
You certainly will. We also talk about television on LKTV and all kinds of things on Linoleum Nights. We do a periodic thing called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we go in deep on a movie. We just talked to our very good friend Dennis Hensley from the Dennis Anyone podcast about Xanadu.
And that episode lasted like twice as long as a normal episode of Linoleum
Knife.
Well,
it turns out that every significant event in Dennis Hensley's life is somehow tied to Xanadu. So
yeah.
What are you going to do? I'm still trying to figure out how he met a woman named Kira who was named for the movie who's never seen the movie.
Like, that was a good one.
Like,
that was my favorite
one.
Yeah.
See the movie that you know your parents named you after. That's just, that seems.
Maybe she's just rebellious.
Could be.
Like, guess what, Mom and Dad? I'm not going to watch that movie.
Check me out on my other podcasts, please. I'm on Breakfast All Day with Christy Lemire on YouTube and also as a podcast. Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network. And, oh, hey, the Max Fun Drive starts this week. check that out for more information. And Deck the Hallmark as well. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll read it on the air. You can also leave positive feedback in all those places that we stream. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music at bleu.bandcamp.com. Go see what he's up to. And follow us at LinoleumCast on Instagram and Blue Sky and Facebook. Gary Cotty is
shaking salad right now.
He is he's a salad spinner.
Just walked in shaking salad.
And anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back with actual reviews soon because they're stacking up.
They are.
Until next time.
Goodbye.